Hello, I'm Russell Rowland, author of 56 Counties, A Montana Journey. Welcome to 56 Counties. Devil wears red shoes. The list of the least diverse cities in the country is dominated by cities from Montana, South Dakota, Idaho, and other states in the West. But it might surprise some people to know that this region looked way different when it was first settled. That is especially true of African Americans. When you talk about the African American presence in the West, you have to start with one of the most important contributors to the first expedition into our region, which is, of course, Meriwether Lewis and William Clark's Corps of Discovery. York grew up as William Clark's servant, a slave whose father had been owned by Clark's father, so York was essentially inherited. York was huge in stature, which came in handy during the expedition's travels, and sadly, even in the best accounts of the expedition, he is mostly mentioned only for this reason. In Stephen Ambrose's excellent book, Undaunted Courage, he does tell the story of the men coming upon a band of Arikara Indians who were fascinated by York. Not only were they enamored of his size, but they had never seen a black man before. York reveled in the attention, playing with the children and even pretending to be a beast, chasing after them until Clark decided he was taking the game too far. But as an indication of how African Americans were viewed at the time, the most telling part of York's story happened after the expedition, when Lewis and Clark submitted the names from the expedition so that they would receive their compensation, and York's name was not on the list. Not only that, but York later requested that Clark give him his freedom as payment for accompanying him on the expedition. York's wife lived in a different city, and York naturally wanted to join her, but Clark had the very traditional attitude of a slave owner. Not only did he refuse to grant York his freedom, but he beat him for being insolent when York refused to let the matter rest. Clark never did give York his freedom. I suppose it's kind of fitting that the first black man to make his mark in our country was a slave, considering our country's history, but because Montana was something of a sanctuary for misfits and castaways in those early years, their history afterward offered some interesting and powerful personalities, people who influenced our culture in surprising ways. Chapter 1, The Black Cowboy. It's long been established that many of the early cowboys that worked the cattle drives north from Texas were either freed slaves or slaves who escaped before the Emancipation Proclamation. Some historians estimate that nearly 25% of those early cowboys in the American West were African American. It's not hard to imagine one of the practical reasons for that. Even after the slaves were given their freedom, the attitudes of many people east of the Mississippi did not change. So job opportunities for freed slaves were often limited to working for the same people who enslaved them, usually as sharecroppers, where they barely earned a living wage. Working as a cowboy was way better pay than a lot of these men had ever seen before. They also often found more of a sense of acceptance among these early cowboy crews, which were made up of other outsiders from polite society. It's just one more example of how camaraderie in the early West provided a spirit of survival that overruled any possible racial issues. Part of those early numbers can also be attributed to the fact that some of the early settlers during the homestead years, especially in Texas, brought slaves with them. The entire population was estimated to be about 25% slave around 1825 and rose above 30% by 1860. Few of these early black cowboys became famous for their accomplishments, with the most widely known probably being a man named Nat Love, who became quite an entrepreneur, buying up several businesses in Kansas after starting out as a cowboy. Love published a book called The Life and Adventures of Nat Love, which included this sentiment about his life on the range. A braver, truer set of men never lived than these wild sons of the plains, whose home was in the saddle and their couch Mother Earth, with the sky for a covering. They were always ready to share their blanket and their last ration with a less fortunate fellow companion, and always assisted each other in the many trying situations that were continually coming up in the cowboy's life. In one of the best novels ever written about the West, Lonesome Dove, Larry McMurtry included a black cowboy, Dietz, among his main characters. This character was based on a real cowboy named Bose Icard, an African-American who worked on one of the largest ranches in Texas, the Charles Goodnight and Oliver Loving Place, and accompanied their cattle drive in the late 19th century. Sadly, there is not a lot of recorded history about the black cowboys in Montana, and it's not hard to imagine why. During a time when blacks were barely considered citizens of the United States, and in some cases barely considered people, the people who were writing about the West tended to overlook anyone who didn't fit the stereotypical hero of the day. So the black cowboy fell very much into the same category as the Chinese railway workers or the countless immigrants who migrated to the West only to be cast aside once they were no longer useful. But thanks to a census, we do know that by 1870, the population of black residents in Montana was around 160. Chapter 2, The Buffalo Soldiers. Sad thing about the number of black cowboys that found their way west was that once the open range period ended, many of these men found themselves without a job. It was one thing for a cattle outfit that seldom stayed in one place to have a smattering of black cowboys on their crew. Whatever discrimination these men faced was easier to overlook when they could just move on. But once ranchers started filing claims, building fences, and forming communities, the ugly face of racism came to the forefront again, and it became a simple matter of whether or not a rancher was willing to contend with the predictable reaction he would get from his neighbors if he employed a black ranch hand. Most were not willing to take that risk. So, by 1890, the percentage of black cowboys in the West dropped from 25 to just a little more than 2%. So many of the young men who were working as cowboys went to the next logical option for a job that would provide steady pay and fairly equal treatment, which was the military. During the Civil War, it is estimated that 180,000 black men fought for what was known as the United States Colored Troops. But they weren't part of the regular army. It wasn't until after the war that black men were allowed to enlist. At first, there were 6 designated black regiments, 2 infantry and 4 cavalry. And the enlisted men that were part of these regiments became known as Buffalo Soldiers. They have never been able to determine for sure where this name came from, but the most commonly accepted explanation is that it was from the Native Americans who fought against these regiments and found the black soldiers to be stalwart, worthy opponents, much like the bison they so admired. The name also reportedly referred to the resemblance between the woolly covering on buffalo's heads, which the Native Americans compared to the hair of black men. When the size of the entire military was reduced in 1869, just a few years after these regiments were established, the number of black regiments was cut down to 2 infantry and 2 cavalry. But the 9th and 10th cavalry units became legendary for their abilities in battle. While most Army enlisted men were paid $13 a month with no deduction for clothing, the Buffalo Soldiers earned $10 a month and had their clothing deducted from their pay. Not surprisingly, considering most of them were former slaves, the Buffalo Soldiers developed a reputation as good workers and obedient. They had been well trained long before they joined the military. It's also not surprising that they were often assigned to some of the least pleasant duties, such as fighting the Indians. The Army at that time was under the command of one of the most notorious Indian hunters in American history, Phil Sheridan, of the famous line, "The only good Indians I've ever known are dead." Sheridan put Colonel Edward Hatch in command of the black regiments, and once they were trained, the number of soldiers attached to these regiments totaled over 900. Because so many of the stereotypes about black people were prevalent at the time, the men in charge approached the task at hand as if these men would be difficult to train. One of the officers, Lieutenant J.M. Hamilton, even indicated they considered the whole venture nothing more than an experiment. He said, "The government depended on these officers to solve the problem of the colored soldier." Much of that attitude came about because of the lack of education among these men. As slaves, almost none of them had ever been allowed to read or write. But they surprised the men in charge, and by the time they were ready for duty, their commanding officers were confident enough to trust them with many important tasks, including opening up and protecting mail routes, guarding stagecoach and telegraph lines, as well as serving local communities during conflicts such as the Johnson County War. They built roads and other infrastructures and led exploratory expeditions into some of the national parks, particularly Yellowstone and Glacier, to help map out these regions. In 1888, the 25th Infantry Regiment was assigned to Fort Missoula, and this particular regiment became famous as the Bicycle Corps. The idea came from General Nelson Miles after he attended a bike race in Chicago and decided that bicycles could be considered as a possible alternative for transporting troops. Lieutenant James Moss was in charge of the regiment, and once he heard of General Miles' interest in utilizing bicycles, he submitted a proposal to assemble a group of men from his regiment to do some test runs. Miles approved the request, and Moss reached out to several bicycle manufacturers. The Spalding Company donated 9 bicycles for the first expedition in exchange for featuring the expedition in their advertisements. The 9 men set out from Fort Missoula for the 125-mile trip to Lake McDonald. The trip took 6 days, and when that was successful, Moss planned the next trip to Yellowstone Park, where they received a royal treatment. They returned to Fort Missoula almost 1 month later after an 800-mile round-trip journey. The success of the first 2 trips inspired Moss to request a longer trip. Moss decided to add another 12 riders, bringing the total to 20, including a doctor, Lieutenant James McCarthy. They plotted out a trip to St. Louis, which was about 1,800 miles away. The group departed from Fort Missoula on June 14, 1897, and immediately encountered challenges as the result of bad weather and mechanical problems. They followed the railroad tracks for most of their journey and made plans for food to be delivered every 100 miles so the soldiers wouldn't have too much to carry. As it was, each rider carried 2 pairs of summer socks, 1 pair of winter socks, 1 pair of summer drawers, 1 pair of winter drawers, 1 toothbrush and powder, 2 handkerchiefs, 1 cake soap, 1 towel, 1 meat can, 1 knife, 1 fork, 1 spoon, 1 tin cup, 1 knapsack, and 1 haversack. Each soldier also carried a shelter half, tent poles, mosquito netting, a Krag Jorgensen rifle, a cartridge belt with 50 rounds, and a bayonet. Bicycle Corps arrived in St. Louis just 1 soldier short of their starting total on July 24th to a cheering crowd of more than 40,000 people. Moss was so pleased with the success of this project that he immediately submitted a request for the Bicycle Corps to be allowed to continue their journey into Minnesota. But it just so happened that General Miles was in Europe at the time. The request was denied. The Army was preparing for the Spanish-American War, and once trucks became more available, the Bicycle Corps became a forgotten footnote in American history. But the Buffalo Soldier still participated in several significant events, including playing a pivotal role in this famous charge by Teddy Roosevelt's Rough Riders. When Teddy's unit was taking fire from all directions on San Juan Hill, it was the 9th and 10th Cavalry units that charged forward to clear the way. The Buffalo Soldiers also heroically served their country during the biggest forest fire in American history. Chapter 3, The Big Burn. Just after the turn of the 20th century, the government was seriously considering doing away with the National Forest Service. But 1910 proved to be a very dry summer. During the years heading up to that summer, the U.S. government, thanks mostly to Roosevelt, had declared over 180 million acres of forest reserve. Forest Service was put in charge of caring for these reserves, but the man in charge of the Forest Service, Gifford Pinchot, had a misguided theory that controlling fires was one of the primary goals, rather than allowing some controlled burns to clear away undergrowth. Pinchot's approach led to a vast amount of overgrowth in the national forest land. And when Teddy Roosevelt decided not to run for re-election, and William Howard Taft became president, his administration cut the Forest Service budget to the bone, further compromising whatever safety measures were in place for firefighting. The Big Burn, as it came to be called, started as many big fires do, as a series of smaller fires. There were hundreds of thunderstorms that summer that didn't produce any moisture. So a series of thunderbolts peppered the region, starting thousands of fires. Sparks from railroad cars were also a culprit. And with the Forest Service budget cut so dramatically, they found themselves shorthanded and began hiring anyone who was willing to work to fight these fires. Once the fires combined into one huge mass, spreading all over western Montana, into Idaho, and south into Wyoming and Utah, the need arose for military action, sometimes to evacuate towns that were in trouble, and sometimes to keep men from deserting their jobs, which is where these two regiments of Buffalo soldiers distinguished themselves as heroes during this tragedy, which is still to this day the largest fire in the history of America. The soldiers were called in from Fort Spokane to help evacuate towns all over Idaho and Montana, and they were later credited with saving hundreds of lives. Chapter 4, Outstanding Service. One of the most fascinating stories from the time of the Buffalo Soldiers was that of William Cathy. Cathy was actually a woman who was freed as a slave in 1861. After the Civil War ended, Cathy disguised herself as a man and enlisted. And I have to think the enlistment process was a lot different then, because anyone who has gone through that process now would not be able to hide certain physical qualities. But Cathy was able to keep her identity hidden for several years, serving garrison duty with an all-black regiment in New Mexico. Another standout was William Flipper, who graduated from West Point in 1877 after enduring years of harassment by his white classmates. Flipper, a former slave, was the first black cadet and also the first black commissioned officer in the U.S. Army. Flipper led his regiment in several battles during his time as an officer, and as a trained engineer, he was also instrumental in carrying out important surveys, constructing roads and telegraph lines, and maintaining the forts where he served. Sadly, Flipper's status as the first black commissioned officer also led to a predictable response from men who weren't thrilled about a black man serving in that capacity. Later in his career, when money was found to be missing from his regiment's books, Flipper was accused and court-martialed. Flipper insisted that he'd been framed, and he was later acquitted of the charges, but that didn't stop the Army from dismissing him. Flipper spent the rest of his life trying to clear his name and join the military again to no avail. But history eventually righted that injustice, and today West Point has an award named after Flipper, given to cadets who overcome adversity. Leading up to the Mexican-American War around 1843, explorer John C. Fremont led one of the first expeditions, in part to explore the West, but also to prepare for war with Mexico. Included in Fremont's crew was a black man named Jacob Dodson, who had been born free. When the war broke out, Dodson was not allowed to enlist because he was black. Fremont still enlisted him in his crew, even though it wasn't legal. When Fremont set out on an 800-mile journey to New St. Louis to warn of a possible attack, Dodson was the one he took with him. Dodson later offered to organize a black regiment during the Civil War, but his offer was refused by the Secretary of War, who was still skeptical about the value of African-American troops. Benjamin O. Davis was another Buffalo soldier who made a significant mark on the U.S. military. After enlisting in 1898, Davis served valiantly during the Philippine-American War, as well as World War I. But for decades after this, Williams was confined to less desirable and less distinguished assignments passed over by his white counterparts. That changed during the presidential campaign of 1940, when FDR recognized the need to appeal to black citizens to support the growing war in Europe. Roosevelt promoted Davis as the very first black general in the U.S. Army. Toward the end of his distinguished career, Davis was called upon to prepare an extensive report about racism in the military for President Harry Truman. Chapter 5, African American Women of the West. There are a few groups of people in the world who have struggled to find the proper recognition for their achievements than that of African American women. And there are some shining examples of black women who had a powerful impact during the early days of the American West, including in Montana. One of the most fascinating stories is that of Biddy Mason. When Mason was 18 and living on a plantation in South Carolina, her slave owner gave her away as a wedding present to a man named Robert Smith. For the next 17 years, she and her sister served Mr. Smith and his family, who eventually moved to Utah, where they converted to Mormonism, and then to California, where Smith unknowingly endangered his own ownership because California was a free state. Biddy had given birth to three of Smith's children by this time, and when Smith announced another plan to move to Texas, Biddy had developed a strong foundation of friends who were encouraging her to petition for her freedom. She and her sister filed a request along with all of their offspring, and much to Smith's chagrin, they won. At the age of 35, Biddy Mason suddenly found herself a free woman, and few people have approached their new lease on life with such zeal and intelligence. Over the course of the next several decades, Biddy Mason started by earning a modest living serving as a midwife and nurse, slowly tucking away enough money to invest in property. She started by buying two lots and building small rental buildings on each of these lots. She eventually built a two-story office building to handle her property management duties. And before she was done, she would be worth over $300,000, a fortune at the turn of the century. The properties that Mason owned also happened to be located in what would eventually become the financial district of Los Angeles. So when her relatives sold them off after Biddy was gone, they made a fortune. But Mason did not build her fortune out of greed. She was a generous donor to many causes in her community. She founded the first black church in Los Angeles, the first American Methodist Episcopalian church, and she donated land for schools, hospitals, and other churches. When a tragic flood hit the region in the 1880s, Mason set up an account for food for any flood victims who needed help. Her home became known as the House of the Open Hand because of her generosity. In Montana, by far the most famous African-American woman was Mary Fields, also known as Stagecoach Mary. Fields was born around 1832 in Tennessee to slave parents, and it was during her childhood that she met the woman who would be instrumental in Mary ending up in Montana. Sarah Therese Dunn couldn't have been more different than Mary. She was white, a slight young girl, the daughter of wealthy parents, but for whatever reason, she and Mary, who would eventually grow to be 6 feet tall and nearly 200 pounds, developed a special bond. After the Emancipation Proclamation, Mary took a job working on a steamboat that traveled up the Mississippi, and it so happened that Sarah's brother, Edmund Dunn, who had become a judge, was also on that vessel, and hired Mary to work for him as a servant, moving her into his home in Akron, Ohio, which happened to be where Sarah had moved after becoming a nun. Sarah, now known as Sister Mary Amadeus, eventually answered a call that took her to Montana. And when she fell ill a few years later, Mary Fields immediately set out for Montana to help her friend recover, and she never left. Sister Mary Amadeus recovered, and Mary Fields became a fixture in Cascade, Montana, where the sisters had set up a mission for the Crow, Northern Cheyenne, Gravant, and Blackfeet tribes. Mary Fields spent her first 8 years in Montana helping to build that mission. She also did all the laundry, tended the garden, raised the chickens, and drove the freight wagon to deliver food and supplies. But Mary became well known for her temper, and she wasn't afraid to stand up to anyone. She was also known to gamble, smoke cigars, and drink with any man. She was quick to respond to an insult. Her temper eventually led to a duel with a man that she nearly killed, and it was this incident that led the bishop of the mission to ban Mary from living there. But Sister Mary Amadeus was a loyal friend. She set up a restaurant in Cascade, which Mary tended to for the next several years. Despite her size and her temper, Mary was also known for being very generous and kind-hearted, and running a restaurant turned out to be a very bad career move, as she often gave food away to those who were in need. The restaurant eventually went out of business. But Sister Mary Amadeus again came to her rescue, this time lining her up with the perfect job to fit her skills as a driver for the U.S. Postal Service. Mary drove the stagecoach that delivered the mail for 8 years, driving the 19-mile route without ever missing a day of work. One of the more legendary stories about this job was when a pack of wolves scared the horses and overturned the stage. Mary sat up all night with her pistol, keeping the wolves at bay until someone came to save her the next morning. By the time Sister Mary Amadeus took another assignment in Alaska, Mary was too old to make the trip, and she was also struggling with keeping up with her mail job, so she retired and settled in Cascade, where she spent her final years babysitting local children, continuing to grow a vast garden, and becoming a beloved member of the community. True to her independent spirit, when Mary felt her time coming to an end, she went and lay out in a field, preparing to die alone. But she was discovered, and the community rallied to get her admitted to the hospital, where the townsfolk surrounded her until her death. Another remarkable African-American Montana was a native of the state. Alma Smith Jacobs was born in Lewistown in 1916. Family moved to Great Falls when Alma was a child, and after graduating from Great Falls High, Alma attended Talladega University in Alabama and then went on to Columbia, where she got her degree in library science. Alma moved back to Great Falls after graduating with her new husband, World War II veteran Marcus Jacobs, and she started a job at the Great Falls Public Library, where she became head librarian just 8 years later. Jacobs was quick to dismiss the idea that her race was significant to the work she did, saying in a 1967 interview, "I don't consider myself the Negro authority in Great Falls or any place else. I resent being thought of as a Negro librarian. I would rather concentrate on being a good librarian." But as the African-American population of Montana dwindled, she also served as an important reminder to those who did stay that it was possible to distinguish yourself as a minority in Montana. Jacobs was president of the Montana Federation of Colored Women's Clubs and served on the Montana Advisory Committee of the U.S. Civil Rights Commission. She was very vocal about segregation in Great Falls at a time when it was unpopular to do so. Together with her sister, Lucille Smith Thompson, she also documented the history of African Americans in the state, an effort that resulted in the 1970 publication, The Negro in Montana, 1800 to 1945. Jacobs eventually became the first African American to be named the Montana State Librarian in 1973. The list of other distinguished African Americans in Montana is long and varied, and thankfully people at the Montana Historical Society and other organizations are doing great work to compile more information about these people. So please make the effort to learn more if you're interested. You've been listening to 56 Counties. I'm your host, Russell Rowland, and I've been talking about some of the African Americans who had an impact during the early days in the West. I'd like to thank my son Fletcher for his musical interludes, and please tune in on the first Monday of each month for another episode of 56 Counties. I'm gonna turn water. Nasty old clicker there.